Good afternoon. Welcome to the January 10th, 2022 meeting of the Chelan Public Utility District Commission. My name is Steve McKenna. I'd like to thank you for joining us today and remind everybody to please silence any of your electronic devices that you may have with you if you are not on mute. And I would ask everyone that's not speaking to please put their devices on mute so that our audio is performing well. Today's meeting is a combined study and business session today due to our abbreviated agenda. We welcome the public's input and remind you that these meetings are recorded. If you wish to address any item on the agenda today, we ask you to please state your name and address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes. Today we have all five commissioners present. We have our new general manager, Kirk Hudson, starting his first meeting. So welcome, Kirk.
Thank you.
General Counsel Eric Wahlquist and Rebecca Newman, Clerk of the Board. Gary Arsenal is commissioner is in person. Gary, do you have any comments you'd like to make today?
Not yet. Thank you, Steve.
Oh, nice. Okay. So at this time, I would ask you to join Chad DeLoop.
Chad Dulac.
Dulac, in leading the Pledge of Allegiance and a safety minute.
Thank you. If you would please rise and join me. I pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Malachi, nice to see you again. I think it's been 30-some years since our graduation from high school.
Just trying not to count that high.
Yeah, right.
Good to see you, Chad.
For those of you who don't know me, my name is Chad Dulac. I am a technical writer under the Technical Library, which is part of Hydro Generation, formerly under Mr. Hudson. Today, I'm going to be talking to you about the Technical Library's implementation of human performance improvement and how we utilize that and the skill sets for standard operating procedures, or SOPs. A quick background about me. I graduated class of 92. I joined the Navy the same year. 23 years later, I retired as a lieutenant as a public affairs officer in 2015, and I was hired on at the district in 2018. The next year, we changed everything. The things I'm going to be discussing with you today is legacy procedures, what it looked like before 2019, some of the pitfalls and the shortcomings with the documentation that the district had at that point. I'm then going to explain how, with asset management, hydro generation, and the technical library, incorporated HPI performance skill sets into standardizing what we have across the technical document spectrum for the PUD. And then I'm going to showcase what those methods are, how we actively implement them, and give you examples about what the old version looked like and how we're incorporating HPI today for all procedures. Some of the problems that we had before 2019, when I refer to a legacy document, I mean any document that existed at the PUD prior to the change of the HPI format. There were multiple steps that were in a single line, meaning when you read through a procedure, you might find something that gave you 5 steps that were buried in a paragraph, and it didn't call out specific things. This would lead to confusion, and it would also lead to some steps being missed. Additionally, there was a lack of safety on some of these, either at the beginning to warn the crews about what they're doing or throughout the document itself to showcase how we could keep people safe. Documents were hard to find. The titling was wrong, meaning if you were going to have something like removing a light bulb, instead of a light bulb removal procedure, it would say LBREM RR SOP. So not only could you not find what you wanted, but you didn't know where it was saved as well. This also had poor version control. If I was a person dealing with the document and I updated it, I could keep a copy of that on my own hard drive or keep it buried in the U drive on the local share servers, but nobody else could get to that, and then I retire and that information is lost. These were just some of the issues. An example of some of the problems that we have, this is an actual procedure that was to articulate how to remove the rotor from one of the large units at Rocky Reach. You notice that the title at the top is a watermark, so it's hard to even know. This is the very first page. This is what a technician would see when they open it up. The page numbering reads as a fraction. While we've got versioning and reference numbers to what document this actually is, there's no previous history about what it was or who actually approved this for use by the crew. The most bold thing that's on here is referenced to a print, but the print doesn't even explain what it is. You'll see that there are tons of assumptions that need to be made by the crews, by the planners, and the people that are issuing this work to be given out. And now imagine that you're a person at the deck plate level that has to use this and try and be successful. Last thing I want to point out is if you look at the very first step, there's not even any direction for you. It's more information about how it was done. This was a commonplace problem about, hey, we're going to teach you information about what to do, but not really tell you what it is because the assumption of knowledge was handed down from person to person. Additional shortcomings were there was a lack of continuity, and this was from plant to plant and from document to document, meaning a document at Rocky Reach would look different than a document at Rock Island. An operator procedure would look different than a mechanics procedure, and even central maintenance documentation for how to do work would differ between how they would do it and how the plant would do it. And this also was a chain of quality control issues. Lack of approval, meaning you couldn't find who actually approved a document for use. There was no names attached to them, and there was a big disparity between how the maintenance and the operational documents were handled. Another small example, just to point these out so you can see the contrast. The safety here, grinding welds off the lock nut. It assumes that the person knows how to use a grinder and what the appropriate PPE is for doing that. The image that's there showcases a picture of something. There's no reference number to say what it is. There's nothing in the step that identifies what it's attached to or what that piece of equipment is. And even at the bottom of this published document that people could use, there's a spot that says future photo. This is not doctored up. This is exactly how it appeared. The last step also has assumed knowledge that a person knows how to tandemly connect the two large powerhouse cranes that are there, as well as where to find the beam, as well as how to attach it, and that's all listed as one big step. So how did we fix it? What did we do as the technical library? Working with asset management, Janelle Ulrich at the time, who's currently in licensing, was the leadership at that, and she brought together all the stakeholders. These were the superintendents from each plant. These were the central maintenance superintendents from each plant. These were operators, chief operators, and all the other folks involved. We even brought in fisheries and hatcheries. We put them all into one room, and we made sure that if we're going to build something together, we're going to do this unanimously. We, as the technical library, myself and Joe Herkenrath, as the two technical writers, went down to the Tri-Cities and worked with Lucas Engineering, and they taught us how nationwide public utility districts are teaching and implementing the human performance improvement asset into all their procedures. We brought together the SMEs, our subject matter experts, and we said, if we're going to build a document for you to use, what do you want it to say? And then we listened to them and put all that information together. We created a new naming convention that was action-based, so when it says that you're doing a procedure, it'll tell you if it's a removal, an installation, a testing, an inspection, etc. And all this is built based off of the asset hierarchy that we have here at the district. Starts big at the plant, goes to the unit specific, down to the component, the action verb, and then we actually get down to the procedure. Along with that, we built two SOP templates because one size does not fit all, some for mechanical and maintenance, and the other was built for operations. We also made sure that we had buy-in from the stakeholders, all of the superintendents, and the representative levels of authority in between that they would want to accept and be responsible for this. So that means when I say, I've got a procedure for you to review, they say, I understand that I need to sign this. That's part of my responsibility to make the system work. And we got that agreement, and everybody agreed to it. And so once we did that, we started building a repository for all of these. Instead of having everything spread across FileNet, across all the different share drives between people's personal folders. We said, none of that really matters now. We're going to collect all the things that we have procedure-wise within the PUD, and we're going to put it under one SharePoint site that's now the official technical library. If it doesn't come from our site, it shouldn't be used. We got acceptance and buy-off to be able to do that and became the one-stop gatekeepers of the information. This means that all of our older legacy documents that we had were hidden or they were converted to the new version. This made it so that if a person was trying to find an antiquated document, they might be able to find a copy of it somewhere, but since it wasn't approved through us, they would come to us and say, let's build it better, or let's go ahead and revise it and see if it's still valid as is. The new standards that we put into it, we standardized what the template looks like, so you can go to any plant now and pull up any procedure that we own, and it's going to be exactly the same. All the categories are the same, all the documents and the respective fields are the same. We state pertinent information prior to the steps. One of the issues, if you say, go ahead and grind this off, and they grind it off and they say, well, be careful, this may drop and fall. We put that in front of it so that if a person understands before they cut something that it's important to know that this could fall. No, this may fall when you grind it off, and then you tell them to grind it. Only relevant information, all the information that's at the beginning of this, subject matter experts tell us what to put in these documents. If you've ever had a toaster, if you've ever gotten a microwave or something that you cook with, the instruction booklet has 3 pages of safety features about how you're not supposed to put your hand where it's not supposed to go. And then at the very end, there's 5 steps on how to use the toaster. We make sure that when you read through this, the person who's using that document knows that the relevant information is there, was put there by one of their peers. That I don't put 50 steps worth of useless things in there. I only put in what they tell us to so that that entire document has integrity and it also has validation by the crews that use it that it's necessary to be in there. And then we use action verbs boldly to identify what the tasks are to establish clarity. Hopefully that can be seen. It's a little small. This is an example of what one of our current SOPs look like. This is the same document that I showed you earlier. This is the rotor removal for the large units, or the small units, rather. You'll see that the title has changed. It identifies RR for Rocky Reach, the hierarchy that's identified there, an introduction that states the purpose. It's hard to see, but there's a watermark in the back that says approved. Any document that we produce that is not approved says draft. So if a person pulls up a document and they're holding it and it says draft, they know that it's not approved. Additionally, we clarified the requirements and references by identifying specified sections. Everybody knows where the tools, parts, and materials are, and we only put what they want. A safety section was put right at the beginning because it was absent from most everything else. If there's relevance for the safety, not only is it put at the beginning of this, confined space entry, arc flash dangers, grinding or heat issues, it's also incorporated at the exact step when that happens within the body of the procedure. And I also lift up that we put in component weights to allow the crews to understand when they're going to be dealing with heavy to move equipment and to be able to plan in accordance with this before they get to that step once they're halfway through it. So some of the standards that we've got that we're very proud of, we have one task per line. It takes away the ambiguity and it takes away the risk of a person having to assume 5 different steps. The tasks are written at the appropriate user level. Some things where you've got a master craftsman who can understand because they've done this 20 times, we have to understand that this could be passed to a person who is taking over for somebody that retired. Is it at the appropriate level and it's written to at least a journeyman level? The review and approval publication guidance is strictly followed, meaning if I build a procedure and somebody doesn't get back to me for 5 months on that document, even though somebody may be asking for it out in the field, I refuse to publish this because it hasn't been validated safe by the leaders who own it and are responsible for the crews that are going to be utilizing that. So we follow through and make sure that that system is in place. And then we also have the ability to revise documentation in a very fast way. So if somebody says I need to change 5 lines, we'll change it, turn it around, make sure it's approved in the same capacity as it was designed, and then we'll republish it over the old one so that there isn't an issue with trying to find 2 different copies. Which is the newest one. We just override it so there's only one. Some examples of this, you can see in the crane coupling, if there's a procedure that's related to it, we put it in the body and share links to it. This is an example of how we've got the notes and precautions that happen before a step is meant to occur. You have all the items that are actionable in order, sequenced in number, and the action verb is at the very beginning in bold to make sure the person understands what they're doing with that. The figure, if you look at line item number 5, not only does it say install the lifting beam pins, the figure 3 is pointed out there. It also shows that figure 3 is off to the right, and there's multiple things that take away guesswork about what the lifting pin is. We're not trying to put a sense of redundancy in here for the sake of dumbing it down. We're doing it so that if I can understand it as a technical writer when I build this, the mechanic is going to understand what these components are when they're looking at it, and that's where we're going. At the end of each document, we have a record of change. The record of change is going to have who it was reviewed by. It's going to have the middle managers, whether it's a CM superintendent or if there's a supervisor that looked at this. And then it also has the SME, the subject matter expert, the person who physically helped write this document and turn it around with all the specifications. The description explains what was done. If there's a minor change, that's implemented there. The date and then the version number is updated, and the watermark reflects the current version. You'll never find a document in the technical library, at least the ones that I've built with, that have a, if the version at the bottom and the date don't line up, you should hardly ever find anything like that. So in summary, making technical documents is a very, very busy thing to do. We've got lots of customers. We have lots of places where these are kept. Technicians use them, operators, fisheries, and hatcheries. Our goal is to make sure that we unify the concept of this, implement HBI strategies so that the guesswork is taken out of it, the risk is reduced, and it's repeatable and reliable. And to ensure the consistency of the work, it is absolutely critical to make sure that we verify these and make sure that they're accurate for all of our folks. At this time, I'd entertain any questions you might have.
Commissioners, any questions?
Well, Chad, I'm getting feedback. I'm going to turn my machine down here. See how that works. That was an amazing safety minute. As I started listening to you, I thought, this is so much more than about safety. It's just about that Human Performance Initiative really belongs there. Because what this means across the organization is so lasting. I'm impressed. That's the easiest way to say it. I am truly impressed. And I thank you and your team for all the hard work that you've done getting us to where we are today with those. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Other comments?
Chairman McKenna?
Yes, sir.
I'd just like to say, Chad, first of all, hard to believe that it's been 30 years since Wenatchee High School, and Malachi's looking pretty good. I don't have a visual view today, but I would assume you're doing as well. When I went through this presentation on my own, getting ready for the meeting today, I was really impressed with the whole process and the outcome. I've done some technical writing in terms of implementing software programs, and it's a slow, arduous, picky process. Done right, the results are incredible, and I think what you've done and your team really improves the quality of work, the efficiency of our work, and certainly, most importantly, it underlines the importance of safety procedures. And nice job, well done, and really good to hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Bowles. I'd also like to make sure I lift up the superintendents and all the people that helped build these procedures with us. While we've implemented a tool that can be utilized by it, overcoming change was a big thing to do, and that wasn't just one person in one department. That was multiple departments district-wide across 3 different power plants and fisheries and hatcheries. and we've gotten buy-in from them to make this process theirs. So you guys have a great district full of personnel that are open to change no matter what it is for the betterment of making these good and safe practices.
Other commissioner comments? Well, Chad, thank you so much for a great presentation. What I would like to share with you is this is really exciting as a commissioner to have this kind of report, because what it does is that it provides us the feedback and information that one of our key organizational values, one of our vision statements, is around safety. And we've been talking about HPI for a while now, and to see that practically working, helping improve safety, helping improve the legacy knowledge that as we build that and new employees come on, that there's a rich history of information and knowledge that's being shared, and that safety is one of our key values. So this is really an exciting presentation today for me as a commissioner. It means a great deal, and I would just like to thank you and the other staff for taking that vision seriously and making it a legacy work of our organization and a legacy value of our organization. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. McKenna. I'd also like to share with the other commissioners that when we were in training with Lucas Engineering, who are the experts on HPI, who are the foundational people that the Chelan County PUD has been dealing with, when we showed them the templates that we had built and we showed them what we've been using over the last couple of years, they told us that Chelan County PUD is a pioneer of utilizing procedures where other plants, both hydro and nuclear, are also trying to catch up to. So they're learning lessons, but we're at the forefront of implementing. So thanks for enabling us to do it.
And if I can add one other thing, it also represents a cultural change in our organization. And there was a time when we were fairly siloed. And when you create these documents and you reach across all of those different departments and divisions, you have a unanimity in the organization that you didn't have, you know, when you started. And I think that's an important piece of the maybe an unintended consequence, but it's certainly an important one.
Yes, sir.
Well, again, thank you, Chad. Great presentation.
Thank you, gentlemen. Madam?
Okay.
Thanks, Chad.
Now you get to see me, commissioners. I haven't aged nearly as well as Chad or Malachi.
So we'll move into the approval of the agenda. And Rebecca, I'm getting a lot of feedback. Is there anything I can do?
Working on it.
On my end?
I think we'll have it fixed here in just a minute.
Great.
Is that
it's
better?
It's tough listening to yourself. I'm hearing myself twice.
Has that fixed it for you?
I think so. It's a little bit, but it's a little better. Thank you. Okay, let's move into the approval of the agenda. Commissioners, we've been presented an agenda for today's meeting. The staff have recommended item number 8 for consent. Items on the consent agenda are also subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon request of any commissioner. Do I hear any such requests for additions or changes to the agenda? Are you okay with moving item with number 8 to the consent agenda? Commissioners? So it looks like we're okay with the agenda with item 8 moving to off the regular agenda onto the consent agenda. Kirk, at this time, I'll turn the meeting over to you and Andrew Gassell.
Thank you, Commissioner. Our first item is a public hearing for the electric vehicle fast charging rates, and it's been noticed accordingly. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Andrew Gassell for the public hearing.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yep.
Great. Good afternoon, commissioners. I just wanted to provide an update on our fast charging rate public hearing that was continued from our December meeting, and we have had some additional comments between then and now, and so I want to make sure we go over those in an appropriate manner, and then at the end ask for some action from the board. Next slide, please. I'm going to provide some background just to bring us back to where we've been. November 15th, the staff provided the board with a electric vehicle direct current fast charging options. On December 6th, the Board of Commissioners initiated a public hearing, and then they made the decision to continue the public hearing based on comments from the public. I will say during that time, we have also been actively trying to reach out to the two customers that were directly impacted by the rate. And we have been able to have discussions with and hear back from Tesla. And I believe Bill Ehrlich is also on the call. And I talked to him earlier today. And I will summarize his comments a little bit later. And then if he can hop in and add anything additional to that. I see his number up there. Next slide, please. So a review of our recommendation, we had three options. It was either the status quo under Schedule 2, it was going to a market rate, or it was utilizing our cost of service with a COSA energy rate and a COSA demand using our three-month critical peak period. And the staff recommendation was option 3. Next slide. We also looked around at how it compares to other similar utilities. And we noticed that we have Snohomish and Tacoma Power have both implemented DC fast charging rates. They have a phased-in approach to their rates where their year one demand charge is extremely low, but their final demand charges are higher than ours. It is should be noted, though, that as our final demand charge is looking to be or recommended to be implemented in 2023, the final demand charges for both Snohomish and Tacoma are several years later, in 2029 to the 2030 time period. And then as we looked through the utilization rate of the current, one of the current fast charging stations, the hypothetical hourly rate where we took the bill and divided it by how many kilowatt hours there were, you can see there that the rate would be either consistent or lower than the other utilities that we looked at. Next slide, please. So some summary of our public outreach. We did provide links for materials and a place to comment at our EV website. We sent formal letters to inviting comments to customers directly impacted by our proposed rates. We contacted local entities as well as Plug-in North Central Washington. We posted public notice for rate hearing for the Wenatchee World, and we've also provided time during the December 6th meeting as part of the public hearing process for public comments. Now we've also been busily working to try to gain some direct comments and direct good discussion with our two customers that are impacted by the rate. Next slide, please. So we have received comments, both verbal as well as written. The next two slides are an overview of those comments. I think primarily there are kind of three main areas that were under, that sort of drove the majority of the comments. One was, how do we know the majority of Chelan EV owners don't regularly use DC fast chargers? Another was, the rate will just disincentivize DC fast charger development. And another sort of overarching was, why is the rate going from Schedule 2 to its own DC fast charging rate? Or why are we looking at that or proposing that? I'll tackle the last one first, because I think it's the most pertinent. The DC fast charging rates and fast chargers have a much different load profile than our standard or Schedule 2 customers. Generally, they have low usage with high spikes. This creates different costs and needs on the system than our than the customers that are generally under a Schedule 2. They generally have a much flatter flatter profile. It doesn't put as much, we don't have to, there's not as much impact on the system, or it impacts the system differently. And so the primary reasoning is just the different load profile and usage shape of that load on our system. Whether or not the rates will disincentivize DC fast charging development, that's one that's hard to say. We do know that through regional dialogue with other DC fast charging developers and owners, they prefer to have increases in increases phased in over time. That's one of the reasons why we're recommending phasing this in over the next couple of years. And we felt it was reasonable to wait until the Washington Low Carbon Fuel Standard took effect, so that the credits generated by these owners can help offset the increased costs. Also, as we look through things, it doesn't appear that the rates are based on a rate they are charged by Chelan PUD, so the rates that DC fast charging companies don't charge. For example, the rate EV drivers pay at the pump is around 30 to 40 cents per kilowatt hour, $3 to $4 a gallon equivalent in our area. And based on current utilization, the current rate charging station owners are charged about 7.5 cents per kilowatt hour, 75 cents per gallon equivalent. So we don't see a real link between the two. That's not to say there isn't, but I think the answer to that question is we don't know. I think that, that's just a hard one to say. So we don't have an answer to whether or not it would disincentivize usage or that development. And then with regards to how do we know a majority of Chelan EV owners don't regularly use DC fast charging others, we don't know exactly, and specifically we don't track everyone that goes and uses them. We have two points of data, though. One is a 2000 regional 2017 study that forecasted 90% of the charging would occur at home. And then we also have received information from Plug-in North Central Washington that uses the statistic of at least 85% of EV owners charge at home. I think this tracks both anecdotally with what staff has seen and knows, as well as what economically makes sense. Customers that are charging at home are 30 cents a gallon equivalent versus $3 to $4 a gallon equivalent using a DC fast charger. But I think just using that information, it's fairly, I think it makes sense that would be the case. So if we go to the next slide, I think this is just a additional ones that I've covered already. Another one was that it would, I think another one that maybe wasn't covered in the last three comments I made were the rate violates stated commitment to electrification and environmental stewardship. And we don't have a stated electrification goal per se, but we do serve approximately 98% of our customers' power needs from energy produced at our facilities. So we have a strong commitment to helping our customers use that energy more efficiently. It increases the amount of our clean, renewable hydropower that's available to local customers and the region, which helps support integration of other renewables. We also have a long and robust history of environmental stewardship in many areas as well, which I don't believe will be diminished by the proposed rate. And I think that by developing a rate now, and providing one that's easy to understand and administratively uncumbersome, it provides future DC fast charging owners with transparent and stable pricing, so they can develop appropriate rate cost recovery mechanisms to their pricing. And again, ultimately, it's hard to know if the rate will disincentivize new development. However, state and federal programs that look to incentivize charging should decrease the chance of this happening, and these are programs Chelan PUD will assess as well forward in the future. We did receive, I was able to contact, as I mentioned, Bill's name earlier. He's a senior policy rate advisor with Tesla. I was able to get in contact with him earlier today, and we talked through some things, and he had a few comments that I'll summarize, and then when the time is appropriate, during the public session or during the public comment period, you could discuss further if you'd like. And the first is that he appreciates linking the phase-in of the demand charge to the LCFS. A longer phased-in period for them would be better as they work through it. Generally, Tesla likes to see time-of-use rates to incentivize their usage profile. And we discussed this a little bit. I did tell him, you know, that we've had time-of-use rates in the past with limited effectiveness given our low rates. And that any savings that might accrue through that could be eaten up through the administration of the rate if it becomes more burdensome. I think, you know, we came to, you know, kind of determine that, you know, the time of use rate might be more of a, you know, I guess a show versus a, you know, actually helping and doing something beneficial due to our already low rates. And then another one he had was that he would like to see the ability for future development to have the option to be on the primary service rate where they could buy, own, and maintain their own transformers, et cetera. This is our generally considered our Schedule 3 series of rates. And then we as a staff have not had the ability in the short time period to assess that or to provide a recommendation one way or another to the board on that. And that would take more time for us to do. Next slide, I think, is time for comment, and I'll pass this back to Commissioner McKenna.
Thank you, Andrew. I think at this time, I would like to open it up for questions. Anybody has any questions, and then I'll open it up into public comment, and then we'll go into commissioner questions or commissioner time to study this. So is there anybody that has any questions for Andrew before we get into the public comment? Not hearing any requests for questions for Andrew, I will then, Rebecca, open it up into a public comment. Is there anything we need, any instructions I need there?
No, people should be able to unmute themselves as they see fit.
Great.
Is this when I should speak up? This is Randy Brooks with Plug It North Central Washington.
Certainly. Certainly, Randy, welcome.
Thank you. And thanks to Andrew for reminding me of the meeting today and encouraging me to comment. Look through the agenda and the factual background and the reasons for this action. As I commented to Andrew in an email previously, the difference in load profile that requires additional equipment or maintenance or service that would separate DC quick chargers from other users in their existing rate schedule is really the determining factor for me about whether or not they should have their own rate schedule. And I don't see a lot of detail about that in either the agenda, factual background, and reasons for action, or in Andrew's comments just now. I wonder if Andrew could explain to me the differences between the customers and the rate schedule they're in now and what they are actually needing as far as load profile and service.
Do you want me to take them as they come, or do you want me to?
Yeah, let's take questions as they come.
Sure. So the load profile, so generally under Schedule 2 is our general commercial customers. They have generally a flatter service. They aren't as peaky, and so the equipment that you don't need to have equipment there that will say will be sitting there idle for a period of time, not recovering costs, versus something like a DC fast charger where you have the transformers put in, all of the equipment is there, and there's no or low usage have that capacity there built in, and then it goes back down again, and we need to be able to then, so we're trying to recover those costs over that short usage period, and so that drives that up, that drives those numbers up some of, more than say, you know, if we're recovering over this longer period of we're recovering over a period much, we're recovering costs spread out over more hours and all the stuff that it takes to be in place there. And so we're constantly taking in revenue associated with that. And so the, you know, the DC fast charging rates just don't operate like that. And so the, you know, the way that we recover costs is different because there is a different load there.
Okay. Thanks, Andrew. I appreciate that. I think I want to comment that certainly DC quick charging stations should pay a rate that is reasonable compared to other customers. And I want to also comment that the factual background and reasons for actions infer that there's going to be a large increase in the number of multi-stall DC quick charging stations in the county. We currently have three, and from Plug-in North Central Washington perspective, we would probably need three more. So I don't think that there's going to be a large number of them that happen. I'd be very surprised if there are. But basically, if the staff and the commissioners feel that a separate schedule is required for these, then because of the load profile, then that certainly seems reasonable to me. And I thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you. Other comments from the public? Okay.
This is Bill Ehrlich from Tesla. I just had one comment.
Hello, Bill.
Hi. Thanks for allowing me to join at this meeting. And as Andrew mentioned, I had a conversation with him earlier about this rate that's going into place. And as of right now, Tesla is two of the three charging stations in the territory. So just to bring up a couple of things to keep in mind as this, as things do develop and move forward, Tesla's charging stations typically have a lot higher usage than other charging stations. So if there ends up being some other types of charging stations in the territory, there may even end up being some variety between, you know, those different stations. So it may make sense to revisit the load profiles kind of, you know, on whatever schedule you're revisiting, probably all of your cost of service studies. I was glad to hear that the cost of service study was done, you know, based on system coincident peak. Oftentimes these public fast charging stations have much lower load factors than what a typical, commercial customer would have, while also, again, doing sort of that ramping that Andrew described to provide fast charging for EV drivers. And, The only other thing that Andrew touched on was I suggested that there is a pathway left open for EV charging customers to take primary service in the future for new stations, you know, if they're larger and that ends up making sense. This seems like a very reasonable option, you know, based on all the things that I've heard in my conversation with Andrew for the station's currently on rate two. But I wouldn't want this to preclude future stations to potentially, you know, be on rate schedule three or the primary service if that is what makes sense. So those are just kind of my perspective, and I appreciate the opportunity to share that with this group. And thank you for your time.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Other comments? Com- Commissioners, I'll turn this over to you. Do you have any questions or comments? So, Kirk, I have a question for you. Given the information that we've had from public comment, are we, is there any pressure time-wise for us to make this decision? Is there enough evidence, comments, feedback to continue to go back and review those, or give me some thoughts here?
Yeah, it's a great question, and there isn't anything timeline-wise that puts pressure on a decision having to be made today. The comment from Tesla came in late this morning, and certainly our team hasn't really had enough time then to work through what it means as far as the resolution and the rate and whether the primary service comment or request affects any of that. And so from that standpoint, I do not see a downside to allowing more time for staff to work through that comment, provide a response similar to they have what they have with the prior comments. I guess there is a downside. It takes staff time to do that. However, I think this particular one is such that we can do that. So I think it is quite reasonable to defer any action at this point.
Commissioners, are you comfortable with that, to take this these last comments and let staff address them before moving on?
Mr. McKenna, I think my question is to Andrew. Do you and your staff feel the need for some additional time to review this and come back with a recommendation that you're comfortable with? Is today far enough, good enough?
I would like to, I don't have the answer off the top of my head, so I would like to take a little bit of time to meet with some of the other team and see what the implications of that are on whether or not it makes sense for us to do that. And I think as Kirk mentioned, we're not under a time gun to get this done today. And I think providing good customer experience and service to all of our customers is important. And I think, you know, taking a look at the time just to be able to, you know, we heard them, we'd like to take a better look at it, and then if the answer can be that much better.
Yeah, I just want to jump in and say I agree. I don't understand the implications of, you know, of what we heard today. So I certainly need more time, more information.
Okay. Other commissioners, any comfortable with that?
Commissioner McKenna, yeah, sorry, Eric. Perhaps given that we're in a public hearing context, the most appropriate way to do that without raising the specter of re-advertising, et cetera, would be for the board simply to take a motion to continue the public hearing until an appropriate time. I'm going to suggest, but it really comes down to Andrew and whether that gives staff time to work through the process. But we could bring this back, could continue it to 1 o'clock on Monday the 24th, I think, is our next board meeting.
I think we can come to a resolution by then.
Okay. Commissioners, do I have a motion to continue?
I would make sense of motion.
Second.
Do we need more information in the
motion? It would be helpful if we could just, and I'm sorry, I should have provided that in advance, but Commissioner Arsenault, if the motion would be simply to continue the public hearing until 1 o'clock Monday the 24th, that would be sufficient.
what Eric said, I would make that motion.
Thank you.
And that's the motion I seconded.
Very yes. good.
Yeah.
All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you very much. And to our public, thank you for your comments. All right. So at this point, we are moving into, Kurt, keep me on board here. We have the quarterly fish and wildlife update.
That's correct. With Thad Mosey and Scott Hopkins. And Aileen Underwood.
Okay. Hi, Aileen.
Hi there, Commissioner. Okay. Yeah, thanks for your time today. I'm Aileen Underwood, Fisheries Manager, Fisherland PUD, and we're excited to bring another quarterly update to you again. This time we're focusing primarily on our fisheries topics at this particular quarter. With me, I've got Thad Mosey, a senior fisheries biologist who's going to discuss the 2021 year-end fish counts, and then also Scott Hopkins, a fisheries biologist who's going to discuss our bull trout study update. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Thad.
Hello, everyone. I would like to cover the adult returns for Rock Island in 2021. I won't be covering Rocky Reach because with the Wenatchee River between Rock Island and Rocky Reach, some of the fish that are counted at Rock Island obviously will turn up the Wenatchee and won't be counted at Rocky Reach, so we'll just focus on Rock Island for 2021. And I'd like to focus on the fifth column of the table, the percent of the 10-year average at Rock Island for the 2021 count. For spring, summer, and fall Chinook, the percent ranged from 75 to 84%. As we moved to Steelhead, it dropped to 44%. Sockeye was about the same at 45%. Then you'll notice with coho, it was a huge percent. That the coho return this year was the largest on record since we've began counting fish in the 1930s at Rock Island. So it was a heck of a coho return this year. Lamprey came in at 18%. And you'll notice that there's a double asterisk there for fish that were trapped at Priest Rapids and translocated upstream of Douglas or of Wells Dam. Both Grant County and Douglas County have an agreement with the agencies to trap and haul lamprey above their projects in an attempt to improve lamprey passage, lamprey numbers at their projects. With the great numbers we have of lamprey passage and passage efficiency at Rocky Reach, the Chelan PUD is not required or doesn't have an agreement to have a trap and haul program. Finally, we thought look at the bull trout. And they came in for the percent of the 10-year average for the 2021 count. It came in at 47% for bull trout. And that's about all I have. Are there any questions?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Do lamprey migrate? You know, we talk about them moving through the dam.
Yes.
I mean, do they go downstream and then back up? Or do they just go up?
Well, the difference between a lamprey and a salmon, they focus on their natal stream where they respond, where lamprey tend to focus on where they pick up on the scent of the juvenile. So there's a large concentration of juvenile lamprey. That's where the adults will tend to spawn. The only reason that an adult would fall back, or go back, I guess, if it overshot an area that maybe it figured it shouldn't be in. But generally, the lamprey move upstream and spawn, and then several years later, the juveniles move downstream and to the ocean. The same kind of a anadromous cycle as salmon.
Okay. Thank you. I was just curious.
All right. If there's no other questions for Thad, I'll go to the next slide and switch gears a little bit to bull trout. So there's two requirements I wanted to talk today about, which fall under the Rocky Reach license, the settlement agreement, in both Rocky Reach and Rock Island bull trout management plans. The first is to do a one-year study of adult bull trout incidental take in year 10 and every 10 years thereafter. And the second requirement is also in year 10 and every 10 years thereafter. And it says the district shall collect tissue samples for genetic analysis of adult and sub-adult bull trout. Next slide. So over the past 3 years, we've been doing a pit tag study from 2019 through 2021. We've submitted and received approval of 2 progress reports to the Rocky Reach Fish Forum. Through the end of 2021, we tagged 90 sub-adult bull trout, and those resulted in 723 detections. Additionally, from previously pit tagged bull trout, we've detected 70 individuals at Tumwater, 6 at Rocky Reach, and 2 at Rock Island. And lastly, we sent 163 tissue samples off for genetic analysis. Next slide. So the study period just ended on December 31st of last year, but we can already make some preliminary observations from the data. The first, the sub-adults that we tagged at Tumwater primarily stay within the Wenatchee River Basin, and they rarely interact with the main stem Columbia fishways. Secondly, the adults show extremely successful passage histories, with many bull trout passing between Wenatchee and Aniat Basins. One fish in particular made 10 successful passages at Rocky Reach, 5 upstream and 5 downstream. And that happened over a course of several years. And the last observation is that genetic analysis of the bull trout tissues revealed genetic assignments to tributary populations within the Wenatchee River that were largely concordant with tributary distributions of the pit tag bull trout. And to put that more simply, the bull trout are traveling to the same areas they're genetically typed to. So for example, the fish that we tagged at Tumwater showed genetic assignments to Chihuahua at 24%, and 22% of the pit tagged fish went to the Chihuahua. So next slide. So what's next? The draft report is due to the Rocky Reach Fish Forum by August 15th, and once that's approved, our next required incidental take study would be scheduled for 2029. So with that, I'll turn it back for questions.
Commissioners, any questions for the team?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Not necessarily related to the presentation, which I appreciate. But recently I've been doing some reading related to the upwellings in the coastal waters and the refurbishing of native food for the species that we track. And the upwellings this summer were greater than they have been in years. The amount of food available this year increased significantly. And just some thoughts in terms of how that may affect our accounts in the future if the regular upwellings return. Because the temperatures in the Pacific off our coast have been pretty warm and pretty consistent. This is a great change. So just curious in terms of your thoughts.
Yeah, Aline, do you want to take the first go at that?
Sure. Yeah, so NOAA just did their annual review of sort of the ocean conditions and what they predict. They put out a chart every year. And in that chart, there are lots of different indicators. There's, you know, upwellings of food species, there's temperatures, and you're exactly right. We are seeing some really good indications that things are looking up, you know, in terms of the indicators trend. We haven't seen these kind of good indicators since about 2012. So I will say, though, that, you know, scientists were also indicating that these things can be decoupled. You know, temperature is different than food availability, and that in our instance, you know, we do have salmon like spring chinook and steelhead that spend multiple years potentially in the ocean looking for forage before they return back to the tributaries. And so when you have, you know, a fish like coho, for instance, they go out 1 year and then they come back. And so that's why they're kind of considered a boom or bust species. But in this particular instance, we're very hopeful that this shows some really good signs. But I think we'll just have to continue to monitor those trends as they continue for those species that spend a lot of time in the ocean. Good question.
Any other questions? Thad, Scott, and Arlene, thank you again for this update, and I appreciate the information.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, commissioners, before us, we have a consent agenda, including item number 8. Do I have a motion to approve the consent agenda?
I would move approval of the consent agenda, including agenda item number 8.
Second.
Call for a vote. All those approving the consent is signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion passes. Okay. Item number 7, Kirk, of our the resolution, item number 7.
Yes, item 7, we're going to skip through with the continuing of the public hearing till the 24th.
Oh, that's right. Sorry.
Nope, that's okay. And then item 8 just got approved, so we're down to item 9.
Item number 9. Thank you for reminding me of that.
Yep. That says resolution rejecting the bid of Lewins Corporation and accepting the bid of Combined Construction Incorporated of Mukilteo, Washington for Rocky Reach Hydro Concrete Repairs. Bid 21-21, and we've got George Velasquez here in the boardroom to present this resolution.
Hello, everyone. George Velasquez, Manager, Engineering Project Management for Rocky Reach and Lake Chelan. As Kirk mentioned, the recommendation of staff is to reject the bid of Lewins Corporation and accept the bid of Combined Construction. A little bit of background on this one. Bid 21-21 includes four main scopes of work. The first one is the adult fishway repairs on the adult fish ladder. There's also some crane rail repairs that have been spalling and cracking since the installation of the new bridge crane. The third piece of work was the center fishway repairs. And then we also have some general maintenance concrete repairs throughout the dam. There were two bids submitted. Lewins was the lowest, however, they did not meet the requirements. They did not submit the bidder's data that was required with the bid. Combined Construction did submit all of the requirements. Lewins' bid was submitted for $528,411. Combined Construction submitted a bid for $550,872,000. The staff recommends that we award to Combined Construction as soon as reasonably possible. We're trying to get the fishway, the adult fishway concrete repairs done before the next fish season, which typically starts end of February. With that, I'll ask for any questions.
Any questions, commissioners? Do we have a motion on number 9?
I would move approval of resolution number 9.
Second.
All those in favor of resolution number 9 signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? And motion passes. Eric. Kirk, let's move into manager items.
Will do. Thanks, George.
Yeah, thank you, George.
Got a few manager items. So I'll start with Carrie Wendell, who will provide the COVID update, the monthly COVID update, and I'll just preface this with some great progress has been made, and we're hoping we can actually sunset this as a monthly report and report on exception basis afterwards, but I'll turn it over to Carrie and then see if that's acceptable to you all afterwards. Carrie?
Good afternoon, Commissioner. Carrie Wendell, Customer Relations Manager. I'm here again to give you an update on the COVID-19 customer impacts related to the past due balances. We're excited today because we're now trending towards getting back to our normal operations. Slide. On this slide here, our outreach continues. The Customer Relations Group almost doubled the amount of emails and credit calls in December, which I believe is why you see the change in the customer data section. So on the, we went from, the past due accounts went from 309 in November to 237 as of December 31st. Of that 237, 95 of those accounts went past due in December. So when you look at those accounts, the actual accounts that are past due from the COVID impacts is down to less than 140. So our customers, we are continuing working with the customers with payment arrangements as well. Next slide. This is the residential field report. From this, as you can see, the door hangers work the best to get in touch with our customers. This is our last step, as we've already made several contacts by phone and email to reach out to them. And once the door hangers left, these customers are getting in touch with us. Our servicemen are help us out a lot on this, so we always appreciate that. Next slide. Our residential past due balances are down to $95,000 compared to the last month. It was $131,000. And then our commercial industrial accounts are staying pretty close to the $14,000. The Helping Hand distribution, we've helped 9 customers for over $2,600. That balance remaining in the account is still approximately $133,000, and we're hoping to see this number grow as we get down to our last group of accounts that are past due. But you'll see from the next slide, and go to the next slide, the energy assistance program. We had a big jump to 145 customers, and over $53,000 was distributed from the energy assistance program. We've received great support from Community Action, and our customers are very appreciative of that assistance that's available. So I passed along that note from last week from a customer who's having a hard time, and now they're getting back on their feet. So it's always nice to hear those positive comments. Next slide. So in summary, over the year, our residential past due accounts have decreased from 400 accounts down to 140, and I think it's really less than that. And then the residential balances have decreased from over 190,000 to 95,000. My group has been working really hard on this, so it was great to see the numbers this month. The number of customers and amounts have increased for energy assistance and our Helping Hand funds, so more customers are reaching out and getting help over the last few months. And then the team is continuing to work with these customers and planning to get back on track with our normal past due account processes by the end of February. So that's where we are. Anyone have any questions?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a comment.
And this comment really is to just congratulate Carrie and her team, who I think are just a reflection of all the staff here at the district. The letter that Carrie referenced earlier was an example of how the staff and the team here at the district always go above board, head and shoulders, to help customer owners going out of their way. And this letter nearly brought tears to my eyes simply because of it was written from the heart. And it was congratulating the customer service team, helping during this very, very difficult time for a family who fell on hard times, was unable to pay some bills, had young children. This was a definite low point in their life. And through the hard work of Carrie and her team, they were able to make sure that they kept the heat on and they kept the lights on. And this family was able to get past this very, very difficult time. And so that letter, as I said, to me, when I read it, the person writing it was writing it from their heart. So, Carrie, congratulations, same to your team and to actually all of the staff at the district who continue to amaze me how much they care and how well they take care of the customer owners of the Chelan PUD. So, Carrie, great job.
Thank you. Thank you. So I just have one more quick thing, unless anybody has anything else. I wanted to also remind everyone that we're planning our annual yearly customer service updates and training day on Monday, January 17th, Martin Luther King Day. We've closed for the last 9 years, and so this is a great opportunity for us to get on track for the year. And so the customer utilities, customer-facing departments will close to allow everyone to attend. And so this week we'll be working with the internal groups involved and to make sure that communication is out there. But just wanted to give you a heads up on that as well.
Commissioners, I would love to have feedback if you're okay or if there are any objections to sunsetting the monthly COVID report, and certainly bring it back if there are things that we see a trend that's changing in the opposite direction. You'll have our commitment to do that, but I would love to get any feedback you have along those lines.
I support that, Kirk.
Looks like you're getting a head nod. Yes, Kirk.
Okay. Thank you, Carrie, and thank you, commissioners.
Thank you, Glenn. Thank you for your support.
Got the next item is wanted to give you a briefing on some tree removal work at Old Mill Park. And Dan Frazier is on for this.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services. Got a little PowerPoint presentation pulled up here, but I wanted to give you a briefing on some vegetation management work that was recently completed at Old Mill Park. So Old Mill Park in the Manson area, it's an area that it's heavy use in the developed area of the park, and a lot less in obviously the undeveloped area. It's an area that has come under scrutiny for more of a firewise landscaping issue, or it really coincides with the district's focus on the prevention of wildfires. So a lot of district properties that aren't heavily used do tend to have a lot of unwanted growth of brush or trees. And in this case, it was an area that had a lot of volunteer tree growth. So the grounds maintenance group is charged with maintaining all the district lands that aren't part of either a park or a fish and wildlife property. And so usually that is a combination of mowing for fire control, weed spraying, and removal of some trees, but usually not too many. But every so often there are some larger projects that this group will undertake, specifically recently around substations, where there was heavy vegetation growth around the Union Valley substation up Chelan. If you've seen the 5th and Poplar substation up 5th Street, there was a removal of old landscaping there and conversion to a more firewise type of landscaping. So if you'll go to the next slide there. So in the, one more. So this is what the area that we're talking about looked like prior to the brush removal. Back in 2018, we noticed this was getting worse. There's a lot of volunteer white poplar trees in the area, a lot of Russian olives, and a lot of dead wood was accumulating. We sent our crews in to try to do some mitigation and some thinning out, and it was just very hard for them to do on a maintenance. It's kind of a maintenance type work. They were having trees fall and deadfall fall around them as they were trying to work. So the area really needed to be cleaned up in a more substantial way. So we brought in our district arborist and checked with him as far as what the proper way to deal with this type of situation is. And because these are mostly non-native species here, it really needs to be cleared out of the things that we're propagating naturally, but not in a safe manner. So the decision was to remove any of the white poplar trees. So there's some volunteer fruit trees in there, Russian olive bushes, and leaving only the healthy cottonwood trees. So the district staff talked with the Manson Parks and Recreation Board. And if you notice on the south end of that site, the Manson Parks is located there. And it's an area that they were actually concerned about quite a bit also from a FireWise perspective. And so their board met and supported doing something with this project. So to make sure that we were letting our customer owners understand what was going on in the area, we developed a mailer. So the next slide, please. So our customer utilities outreach specialist developed a mailer, and we provided this mailer to 27 property owners in the vicinity of the project, letting them know what the plan was. This went out, I believe, back in September, October. We received one response. We had one property owner was concerned because eagles have been seen in the area, and we understand from our wildlife biologists is they like to hang out and wait for fishermen to come in and clean their fish and then swoop down and take care of what's left of that process. So we did consult with our biologist to ask them what's the appropriate tree species and what to leave. And so they provided input and said really leaving those cottonwoods, the tall cottonwoods, would be the best solution. So that's what we did. And in early December, our contractor, Camp West, came in and removed all of the undergrowth, all the Russian olives, and the white poplar trees. So the next slide, that's kind of a stark difference, but it's also winter, so it looks quite a bit different just being winter up there. But so we left a stand of pines that are to the left of there, the five or six of the cottonwoods are kind of off in the distance in the middle. There's an elm tree there. Then you can't quite pick it up here in this picture, but in the back right behind the elm, there's a couple of Russian olives. So that's what was left in order to really look at the site a little differently. And so we're developing a replanting plan with our both the help of our arborist and our fish and wildlife biologists to help us really get the right mix and density of trees and other vegetation that can be both firewise, protect us from those kind of hazards, but also give us a right mix for habitat. The next slide actually shows you that not too long after, this was taken about a week after we finished the work, the eagle was back, and they're hunting in the area still. So that's really what the intent of this was, to make sure we didn't harm any of the habitat that's currently being used by the eagles, but still make it a more safe condition. So you see there was a lot of wood still down on the ground, and our crews will be going in the spring, removing the wood, prepping the ground, and then replanting. We're expecting to actually use some of the cottonwood type stock. There's other things that we've consulted with our arborist and some suppliers to look and see what we would be putting back. But it'll be a more manageable type of planting instead of this kind of wild area that had developed over the last probably 15, 20 years. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. Got one more item, and that's just wanted to make sure the board got an update on a lot of the challenges we had last week with the weather and service to our customers. And with that, I wanted to provide an opportunity for John Stoll and Dan Mosier to provide you all an update on some of the things we dealt with on the customer side of the business and some of the challenges our employees faced in trying to make sure everybody had essential services. So with that, I'll turn it over to, looks like maybe Dan.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm Dan Mosier, Director of Electric and Fiber Operations. Just want to give a quick rundown of the last week for us. Started with Tuesday night and Wednesday night. Both those nights we had a crew up on Stevens Pass trying to clear some trees out of the 115. So we spent about 10 hours per night up there doing that. And then we've got our big snow, of course. Sunnage Canyon up the other side of the river from Dead Horse. We had a tree in the 115 there. That was Thursday. Worked together with the DOT, talking to their avalanche experts to find out how safe it was and when we could get in there and do our work. So coordinate with them hand in hand. The guys made their way in there. We were able to use our drone from across the river and get a picture of where the tree was. So the guys knew, had a real good idea of where to go. So they made their way in there Thursday afternoon, removed that tree. We were able to energize some of that 115 back. And in the process, we were able to move some of our load around and get the town of Plain on, which I'm sure was a big relief to some of those people. So then after we got that done, we still had a tree up on the line going up Stevens Pass. The crews have made their way into it today. Several recon trips with a helicopter to look at access. Again, we worked through the weekend with the DOT to build us a ramp to get off the highway. So just for an idea, there's about a 15-foot sheer wall of snow there that we had the DOT build us a ramp so we could get our snow equipment in there. The crews made their way in there this morning. They started a bit early, found some damaged wires, so they're working on sleeving that wire out. And then we've got a cross arm we've got to put back up on a pole and put some X bracing back on. We're hopeful we can get all of that today, but if not, it should be sometime tomorrow, which will allow us to get the Summit substation back hot, which I think has been out for pretty close to a week now. And then again, this morning we had a submersible transformer go bad downtown. And as anybody can imagine, trying to dig through 2.5 and 3 feet of snow to find a vault just to find the problems was no easy task. But the latest reports I've got is everybody's back in power. So minus the ski area at the top of Stevens Pass and the little community up there just down the hill from them, everybody's back in power. So we'll just keep doing what we do and wait for the next tree.
Great. First of all, I kept looking at the picture of that. It said John Stoll. Man, that doesn't look like John Stoll. So anyway.
I'm off camera, Commissioner. I just want to make sure Dan got some FaceTime.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really threw me for a loop. So anyway, Dan, great presentation, great update. I'm up here in Leavenworth. I've never seen anything like this before. So I just can't imagine the challenges that your teams face getting in and out of those lines in different locations with this amount of snow. Herculean effort by your teams and you guys is greatly appreciated by all of us. And I really appreciate the update. And it's amazing to me. So thank you very much.
Yeah, and I shared with John this weekend, and I wanted to pass it along to you guys, too. We really appreciate the patience and allowing us to do and coordinate with the people that we do to make sure the situation is safe for our guys to go and do it and is There's a lot of things we don't know going into those areas. The picture we showed earlier, it's if you could see it in without snow on it, there's like a lot of little river canyons that move through that that you just can't see when it's covered in 10 feet mm-hmm. of snow. And so it's a really slow process to get in there. You got to make sure you've got good footing with those machines. So again, just I wanted to appreciate on our guys' behalf the patience and allowing us to do things as safe as we possibly can.
And I think the other part of that with our communication staff doing an excellent job communicating with the community on the efforts that are being made to get electricity restored, I just think, you know, that's key in having people with patience knowing that we're working as hard as we can, doing the best that we can. So, you know, again, it's a multifaceted team. It's just not the staff that are up in the snow trying to fix the lines, but the communication people and everybody, it's just a great effort, and I appreciate everybody's. You know, when I look and see a communication coming out to commissioners at 3 o'clock in the morning of what people are doing, great communication, great effort, and I certainly appreciate that. So thank you for the update.
Yes.
I guess, you know, I started out today, you know, saying something similar to what Mr. McKenna has just said. One thing I'd like to add, excuse me, additionally, is every time you guys get busy up in Sutich Canyon and working towards Stevens Pass, I get nervous. My anxiety goes way up. Mm-hmm. That area has a tendency to be fraught with additional concern. And I guess as we hit this level of snow and these kinds of situations, it is my trust that if you run into equipment needs, other kinds of needs, that you take those two channels, because we want every one of your crew to come home every night with every appendage they left with in the morning. And we don't want anybody hurt. We don't want anybody killed. We want to be diligent and take care of our customers. But if there's things that create risk, and we could somehow support you differently or more effectively, please take that through, you know, Kirk and whoever you need to, and let us know where, you know, we can be a support. It is critical what you do, but not as critical as the well-being of your crew.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And we have gotten a lot of support, and we've run a lot of those things up through the channels, and we've got some pretty darn nice equipment out there. And just from my perspective, about our best friend anymore on these things is just time. And when I first started here, we would run in there as fast as we can and then oftentimes have to back up. The approach that we take now, that what you just said, and putting the focus on employee safety and the public safety being paramount, we usually finish things a lot quicker that way when we take the time to plan it before we just run into it. So thank you. I appreciate that.
I'd like to just add kudos to the employees as well. I think Commissioner Bowles hit the nail on the head. Total team effort here across the organization and the response, and everything from getting parking lots cleared so employees had a place to park when they came in if they were able to get out of their driveway, and to getting equipment ready to roll, and the support necessary, the communications both internally and externally, a lot of departments working together. And so just really proud of our employees, and I've heard a number of compliments from customers up in the Plain Lake Wenatchee area when You talk about Sunnish Canyon and Dead Horse Canyon. When things happen, very difficult places to access, and for the lights to come back on late Friday night, that was just an incredible effort for that to happen. And just as a reminder, we are, as Dan pointed out, we do have, you know, issues up at Stevens Pass still, and that does present a challenge for us in terms of our normal contingency if we end up with a tree in the transmission line somewhere between Leavenworth and up. We don't have the ability to backfeed, and so that's paramount for us to just try and get things resolved up there so that we have our contingency in place as well. And with that, that's the end of manager items.
Well, not quite. I think this condition has just been a great way to initiate a new general manager. Yeah. We'll just see how good you are right away. Thank you, Kirk, for your leadership.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Dan. John. At this time, so Kirk, are you finished with manager items?
I am finished with manager items.
I think I'm going to rearrange the schedule here a little bit and invite for public comment. I see some folks, then rather than looking at wading through delegation of items and commissioner travel, et cetera, do we have any public that has any comments that they would like to address the commission before we move on?
And I would just remind those on the phone that it's star 6 to unmute yourself. If that was done from our side.
Okay. Well, we'll continue on then. So is Lisa Sanders available to talk about commission travel?
I am here.
Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hello, commissioners. Seems silly to talk about travel in the middle of all of this snow, but here we are. We have Waputa Association meetings January 11th, well, 12 through 14. I have most everyone joining virtually except Commissioner Arsenault. Is that still your plan?
Yes, that's still my plan. So I'll be traveling, leaving tomorrow to go to Olympia.
Okay. Drive safely.
Yes. Yeah.
Check in when you get there.
Thank goodness the passes are open, at least right now.
Yeah. Okay, and then I have everyone attending virtually Waputa meetings in February. Commissioner McKenna has Energy Northwest. I'm backwards, sorry. And January 26th. Then back
right.
February, Commissioner Arsenault is attending a PPA legislative rally in Washington, D.C.
Correct.
Okay. March Waputa meetings have Commissioners Bowles, Congdon, and Smith participating virtually, and Commissioner Arsenault and Commissioner McKenna weren't sure last time we checked in.
Lisa, I will be virtual on that.
Okay.
As will I.
Okay. Do you want to keep going, or is that good for now?
Commissioners, are we good at this point?
I have a few dates that I could just fill in without going through the entire list. Perfect. For you, Lisa. All right. That is that April 13th through the 15th, Waputa Association. I will be attending that in person.
Okay.
And do you know where the location is for the NWPPA annual conference in May, where that will be held?
I don't know yet, but I will check and see if that's been updated.
Thank you. The June 10th APPA National Conference, I will be attending that in person.
Okay.
And just for everyone's edification, the Waputa Annual Conference, which is way out in December, will be back over in Spokane at the Davenport.
Great. Thanks, Gary.
Gary, do you know where the APPA Annual Conference is going to be held?
You know, something tells me that it, do you know, Rebecca?
It says Nashville, Tennessee.
Nashville. That's what I was going to say, Nashville.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Lisa.
No problem. Thanks.
Okay, we'll move into commission items. First item A is 2022 association representation, and there are no changes from what is listed on the document. We've gone through all of our assignments, and everybody's on board. And Rebecca has that. Any need to go through that, or are we okay to say what's been written we're okay with? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I may have a moment.
Yes, Gary.
I'd like to take this opportunity on behalf of the commission to let Kirk know just how pleased we are and to welcome him as our new general manager. Kirk is a natural-born leader. We've seen that over the many years that he's been with the district. His integrity, his ethics, his dedication to customer service are stellar. Kirk has also exhibited his strong support for the best, for the most, for the longest. And Kirk demonstrates that by living that every day, and we witness that. I just want to let you know, Kirk, how grateful we are as a commission to have you at the helm of this organization to lead us into the future. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you, Commissioner. I'm just say I'm honored, and it's a privilege to serve the district as the general manager, and I'm just thrilled and looking forward to it in a big way. And I'm just excited about serving our customer owners in the new capacity, and I just really appreciate the confidence the board has in me. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Gary, for being there and being in person to share those comments regarding Kirk. We're all glad he's there. All right. Follow up on delegation of items, of action items.
We've got one. That was from the December 20th board meeting. Rebecca provided a hard copy of the power generating pool presentation to all the commissioners, and in normal fashion, she did it the same day.
Great. Delegation of action items from this meeting. Do we have anything?
We didn't catch anything on our end.
All right. We'll again open it up for additional public comment. See if we have anyone there that would like to address the commission. Do we have any other matters of general business that may necessarily come before us today? Rebecca, is there anything I've missed?
I think you're on a roll, doing great.
All right. And to reaffirm, we are not going into executive session today. All right. So at this time, we will adjourn. Anything else? We're adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.